I'd like to give you some background information on Judge Kennedy. She's a United States District Judge, Eastern District of Michigan. She graduated with top honors from the University of Michigan, Bachelor of Arts degree in 1945, Juris Doctorate with distinction in 1947. She's a member of Board of Editors, Michigan Law Review. And she has many honorary degrees as well as those that were earned. She was appointed United States District Judge October 1970, the only woman from Michigan ever to serve as a federal judge. Past chairperson for the National Conference of Federal Trial Judges, the only woman ever elected to this position. And wouldn't you know, next Tuesday, November 22nd, she will have another honor. She will become Chief Judge, again, the first woman. I'd also like you to read the poster that she put on the front. She brought this herself. I think that's fantastic. So, ladies, won't you please welcome Judge Kennedy. Judge Kennedy.
Our first speaker in this section this morning was Barbara Blum of the Environmental Protection Agency, and her presence here reminds me of a story which probably originated with someone who had to deal with that agency. Moses was speaking to God about the prospects for persuading the Pharaoh to permit the Israelites to leave Egypt, and God said to him, "Moses, there's good news and bad news. I've decided to turn the waters of Egypt to blood to bring plagues of frogs, gnats, flies, and locusts, to cause hail to fall upon the Egyptians' crops, to cast boils upon the Egyptians, plagues on their cattle, and kill the firstborn of all Egyptians." "But Lord," Moses exclaimed, "what bad news could there possibly be?" And God replied, "You, Moses, will have to write the environmental impact statement." In a sense, the thoughts that I'd like to share with you today suggest both good news and bad news for the role of a female judge in effecting issues of concern to women in today's America. I promise you, however, it will not be as long as an environmental impact statement. Women judges have a significant potential for advancing the interests of women, but there are also very definite limits on the role that they can play. And I hope that I can illustrate some of these limitations so that you can better understand the problems faced by women judges and won't expect more from them than they can legitimately accomplish. And I also hope to emphasize the limits on what a judge can do, and that those limits on what a judge can do places additional burdens on women in other fields if there are to be more women in the judiciary. Now, let me begin with the bad news first. Both in her handling of individual cases and in her activities in the public sphere, a female judge is greatly restricted by the manner in which she can promote policies of interest to women. The restraints on a judge in hearing individual cases are many. A judge is bound by the law, and very often in cases of particular concern to women, the statutes that provide the rights and remedies in question mandate a framework that simply does not allow steps by the judge that would significantly advance the concerns of women. When I'm dealing with a case alleging sex discrimination in employment, or a case challenging the actions of agencies that run welfare programs, the remedies that are available to me are controlled by statutes that are adopted by the Congress and by the construction of those statutes by appellate courts. And reform of the inequities and inadequacies of those laws must come largely from the legislative branch of government. A female judge who attempts to go beyond what is allowed by these laws is likely to have the decisions reversed by an appellate court. She'd bring disrepute on herself and other women by giving the appearance of making decisions grounded on sexual bias or resulting from incompetence. There are, of course, cases in which a woman judge, by rendering fair and just decisions, can advance the interests of women, and we obviously should, and I hope we do, seize every opportunity to do so. Now, in many situations, the problems of women that come to the judge come in a posture where the situation is virtually hopeless. One of the most depressing of these situations that arises with disturbing frequency in the federal courts is in the criminal prosecution of a woman, frequently a welfare recipient, for an offense involving the distribution or possession of heroin or some other hard drug. There are drug dealers who prey upon young, unmarried ADC recipients. They select ones with small children and no criminal records, and then they offer them some money and a free trip to Mexico, a weekend in Los Angeles, if they'll bring back a package of heroin. The package brought back, the woman's arrested, ends up in court, prosecuted for this sale, a very serious crime. They usually are fearful of the person that hired them, fearful of being killed. And for me, the wrenching part of this situation comes when such a defendant has been convicted and I must determine the sentence. Seldom is there anyone to care for the children. If I sentence the defendant to a criminal or to a prison term, the effect on the children is devastating. If I permit the defendant to remain free, for example, on probation, I may be doing an even greater disservice by perpetuating and encouraging the very practices that have created the problem. If the defendants in such cases, or those with children, are always given a non-jail sentence, the men who induce these women to participate in these schemes can say to them, you won't go to jail, there's no real risk, the judge won't put you in jail. And the sentencing judge is in a very difficult position because of the underlying social problem that she is powerless to correct. Now, there are other situations in which there might appear to be the opportunity and where there's considerable pressure to take some dramatic step in an attempt to advance women's interests, and the need to protect the legal system from inconsistencies and undesirable precedents prevent such action. Recently, we had a case it drew a lot of national attention in Lansing, Michigan, which I think is an illustration of this problem. The defendant in that case was charged with murder for killing her former husband, with whom she was living. The testimony was clear that for 13 years, she'd been severely beaten by him, and on the fatal night, she was beaten again. She left the house with her children, intending never to return. However, before driving away, she returned to the house and poured gasoline upon the bed in which he was sleeping and set the bed on fire, killing him. Now, the defense contended that her actions were the result of the beating, and certainly there's no reason to believe that she would have killed the man if she hadn't been beaten. And there was a great deal of public support for the adoption of a rule that in such circumstances her actions should be considered self-defense, thus precluding conviction for homicide. The growing recognition of the tragedy of battered wives in the United States added considerable force to this argument. There was a great deal of pressure on the trial judge to expand the principle of self-defense to such a situation. Under our law, however, self-protection is a defense only where the defendant is in danger of injury at the time that he or she kills, and that did not appear to be the situation in this case. To have extended the self-defense rules to that situation would have been dangerous, for there would really be no workable way to prevent that defense from being invoked in the case of any provocation, even much lesser provocation, where the defendant has been removed from the immediate danger at the time that he or she decides to act violently. And a judge must not be tempted to create one set of rules for one group and a different set of rules for others. Indeed, I think it's been the objective of women for years that there only be one set of rules. Incidentally, the woman defendant in this case also raised the defense of temporary insanity, and she was acquitted by the jury on that basis. Now, not only is a judge restricted in individual cases, but the ability of a female judge to take a role in the public arena in bringing about desirable changes in the law is greatly restricted. The canons of judicial ethics, and in my case, the code of judicial conduct for federal judges, leaves very little room, very little freedom, for such participation. A judge, a federal judge, may not seek to consult with officials of the executive or legislative branches of government regarding matters other than the legal system and the administration of justice, nor may she make public statements about questions of public policy. A federal judge may not publicly criticize or comment upon a decision of another judge or panel of judges, even though she feels the decision rendered or the conclusions drawn are completely incorrect. Nor are federal judges permitted to solicit funds for educational purposes. Another canon that is applicable to federal judges, but not necessarily to state judges, forbids all political activity. No attendance at political meetings, no contributions to political candidates, no contributions to political parties. Perhaps the hardest limitation on the activities of judges for most people to understand is the inability of judges to publicly espouse causes of critical concern. And this is particularly apparent with regard to causes of concern to women, especially with regard to women judges. However, the canons of ethics forbid any public statement that interferes with a judge's judicial function. And taking public stands on issues prejudices a judge's ability to do her job. There are probably no issues that could not come before a judge sometime, in some case. If the judge has taken a public position on the matter, there is a serious danger that the public's confidence in the ability of that judge to rule impartially on that issue will be undermined. Judges must not give the impression through public statements that they have already decided matters through public statements before the cases are heard. A judge who has expressed a view on matters of public policy may find that when the issues are raised in a case, she's under pressure either to vindicate a previously stated position or that she may be disqualified from that case. It's tempting to respond when asked for an opinion about some issue that's not likely to arise in court. However, it's simply not possible to predict what cases will come before a court or what issues will arise in them. Before the United States Supreme Court had ruled on the issue, I had to decide whether women receiving ADC assistance were entitled to a hearing before assistance could be terminated, and ruled that they were. I've had to rule on the legality of state regulations on abortion clinics, the constitutionality of municipal accosting and soliciting ordinances. I have had and continue to have numerous cases claiming sex discrimination in employment, and presently have assigned to me a case challenging sexual quotas in admission of students to architectural schools. If I had taken a public stand on any of these matters, I could not have been and would not be in a position to fairly judge these cases, and prior statements on the subject would give the appearance of partiality. Even ordinary conversation can be very restrictive at times. In Detroit, where I sit, perhaps the subject of conversation more often than not is something relating to the automobile industry. Yet, I'm not able to express my views on those matters. As a matter of fact, it's crippling even in polite conversation. Not even the weather may be a safe subject. I recently had to construe a federal statute and regulations relating to the preservation of wetlands, in which one of the issues was the amount of rainfall that had fallen. And it's hard to talk about sports, because I've had to rule on an antitrust case brought against our local professional football team. And fashions, like pantsuits and hairstyles, are not even safe subjects, because I've had several cases involving dress codes and hair length regulations in schools, in factories, and in the military service. Now, this necessary withdrawal of oneself from the public forum is very difficult. Most judges are persons who throughout their lives have been active in matters of public concern. A perceptive statement made by Representative Barbara Jordan of Texas was quoted by the Associated Press just recently. As you know, she has been mentioned prominently and suggested for many important public positions in the country. And as to a judgeship, she said, "Once you put on one of those robes, your silence is enforced." I'd like to take just a moment to read to you the oath that a federal judge takes upon assuming office, because I think it expresses the breadth of this undertaking. The oath reads, I do solemnly swear that I will administer justice without respect to persons and do equal right to the poor and to the rich, and that I will faithfully and impartially discharge and perform all the duties incumbent upon me as a United States District Judge according to the best of my abilities and understanding, agreeably to the Constitution and laws of the United States. So help me God. The acceptance of such an oath requires a deep personal commitment and requires a saintly understanding and patience of a judge's family and friends.